The views and opinions expressed by the guests on this podcast are that of their own. In no way, shape, or form do they reflect the official policy or position of the Bottom Dwellers Dive Shack.
You've descended into the Bottom Dwellers Dive Shack, a commercial diving podcast by working divers for divers.
This episode is brought to you by Joint Zone Equipment. They offer hydraulic power packs, underwater hydraulic tools, and their revolutionary underwater lift bags. Their underwater lift bags have raised the manufacturing standards across the industry. No glue is used in the manufacturing process, and all the seams and attachment points are radio frequency welded using a material that provides a higher puncture resistance and a lighter weight. So make your next Joint Zone purchase from one of the stocking distributors such as Rental Tools Online or Amron International. JointZoneEquipment.com, leading from below.
All right, welcome to the Bottom Dwellers Dive Shack.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
I'll be Diver again.
Johnny.
And then we have, we're excited to be in the home of Don Barthelmess. How are you, Don?
I'm great, Mondo. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for letting us into your home, beautiful home you have here right in Santa Barbara. We also have Leslie Laney with us.
Hey, good to see you. Thank you for coming. Appreciate it, especially through this weather.
That's perfect weather.
Yep. So this is a very important episode because not only are we going to kind of talk some diver shop, you know, diver talk, have a little bit of fun, but we definitely want to highlight the diver monument. Deep water dive monument.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's more of a monument versus a memorial.
Yeah.
To honor the pioneers which started the deep water gas diving here in Santa Barbara back in the 60s.
Nice. Perfect. And it's very, very storied location here in Santa Barbara. So as we know, this is kind of where oil field diving started, right?
Pretty much the first offshore oil well was drilled right down the road off Summerlin how many years ago was that? It was in the, back in the 30s. Yeah, when they started on the cliffs of Summerlin back in the, you know, turn of the century, 1898, I think they were working for oil on the cliffs there, and then they soon discovered the natural seepage and stuff from the formation out offshore, and they slowly started to move offshore. And there was a photograph I took from the archives down at the Santa Barbara Historical Society of the first pier that Chevron built. It was actually a wooden pier. And then they went further out, and they had a standalone structure. And that was the first offshore oil well, and oil dive was made there. Yeah, but a gentleman by the name of Rigdon Crawford made the dive back, I think it was 1937 or so.
Yeah. Wow.
Right. So, like, all of a sudden we just started in because you got a lot of divers out there that still think that the Gulf is where it started, oil field diving.
But you're wrong.
Well, that's what the history shows so far. But of course, no one knows everything, and it could possibly have done somewhere else that hasn't been recorded or opened up or didn't work out, but did try something for the first time. But it's generally accepted that it was here.
Yeah, and that's well documented in Chris Swan's book,
exactly.
Which I really, really do love that book, and a great author. Definitely run out there and get it if you don't have a copy of it.
Yeah, that's the Bible of anything to do with oil field diving. And Christopher is also Santa Barbara based. And so if there's one book that a diver needs to understand the history of that trade when it comes to offshore, that's the book.
And you don't have to read it cover to cover. You know, you read it in sections, the area, you know, the time frames that you want to read about. And it's just a book that you can kind of constantly go back to, you know, to get your history. So, deep water diving monument, why the need for one?
Well, basically, Leslie would be the best one to answer that because it was really his brainchild that he came up with years ago. You know, great idea to honor these pioneers. And it materialized just a year ago, November, at a meeting in Dima. Leslie, why don't you?
Yeah, it was. I co-founded the HDS USA, Historical Diving Society USA, here in 1992. And it's steeped in the pioneers of diving, particularly deep water and oil, mixed gas, that were based here. And so we started the HDS in 1992. And as a lot of these divers joined the society and would share their stories, and we looked to sort of, okay, well, how can we preserve this? So I was doing the magazine Historical Diver, but that was print. But there was also a requirement for something I thought more permanent, but I didn't quite know how to go about it. And I had calls to go over to Australia. I bought the remnants of a pearling company back in the 90s, and so I flew over to Perth, and then up to Broome. And in the center of Broome, there's a bronze statue of a pearl diver dressed in high key equipment, the English high key equipment. Oh, wow, that's pretty interesting. Then I ran into another one, another statue in France, in Espalion. There's one by the river. And then there's a sponge diver statue, bronze, in Tarpon Springs, where we had our 2005 conference there for the centennial of the Greek sponge divers. And so when I came back from those trips, I'd suggested that we look at doing a statue in Santa Barbara to honor divers. It wasn't specific deep water divers. We were considering abalone, which is the sort of the ground zero of where it all starts. And the HDS board was looking at it at that time, but also at the same time, one of our board members, Scrap Lundy, was working with a group up in Monterey on the Cannery Row divers. And that project was up and running. So we sort of shelved the statue idea and went and supported the guys in Cannery Row and built, there's a bronze Morse helmet up there. And this was put to one side until sort of rekindled a bit when they did the Mark V monument in Panama City. And then that team, Paul Guyver and Tony Sexton, Brits, I'm a Brit, so we communicate on different levels about diving history, that they were interested in talking about a commercial diving monument somewhere. And they contacted me about it because they wanted to talk to some people at Kirby Morgan. And I said, well, it's funny you should mention that, because this was a project we were looking at maybe, you know, 20 years ago and never got off the ground because we focused on Monterey. And so I spoke to Don about it, and we met Dima Las Vegas in 2021. We met with Paul and Tony there, and we'd spoken to Connie Morgan, president of Kirby Morgan, and got the idea that she would support something like that. And we picked it up from there.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a lot. You know, my involvement with it was being a local resident and worked here for 40 years, was to help usher it through the city process. And knowing what I know about Santa Barbara, how difficult it is to do anything, I figured this is going to be at least a 2-year project. And being that this monument is actually a gift to the city of Santa Barbara, they got behind it pretty quickly. And our waterfront department in here in the harbor, where it's going to be, it's all been approved now, and we're in the fundraising stage. They got behind this immediately, and we went through all the city processes. We started that in earnest probably about a year next month. So February, and then we actually had the first which is right here, the first statuette sculpted and delivered from the foundry in October, which is unprecedented to get through the city approval process that quick. Plus, Paul and Tony, their efforts, you know, being that they've done this before, they knew exactly how to do this. The size and everything we went through started with the Santa Barbara Arts Advisory Committee, and which is a citizen committee of artists, and they can put the kibosh on any piece of public art that goes in Santa Barbara. The only really high visible piece of public art, well, it's actually two pieces. There's, of course, the Dolphin Fountain, which is at the foot of Stearns Wharf, And then they had the Chromatic Arch down further down on Cabrillo Boulevard. Those are the only two really highly visible pieces of public art. So this is going to be, in my opinion, the most visible piece since the Dolphin Fountain, which was constructed in, I think it was 1981. So yeah, we were thrilled to get through and have the support of all the citizens and all the city entities getting behind this thing, and to have approval in August. And then we started with the foundry and the casting and the sculptor down in Simi Valley, Greg Pilintovich. I probably messed up his pronunciation of his last name, but it's Pultanovich. That's what it is. Yeah. And he did all the sculpting. He worked on it for, gosh, what was it? About 10 weeks. Or so.
Yeah,
and then we got the clay sculpted, then off to the foundry, and it's using the lost wax process, which is a very, very fine-tuned sculpture method to get this clay maquette done. And all been approved. Arts Advisory, Harbor Commission next, and then we went right onto the Architectural Board review, where they picked at it a little bit, and we made a couple little adjustments, and here we are. So now we're at the point where we are going to be making only 300 of these limited edition statuettes depicting a diver wearing the classic Super Light 17, which was introduced in the late 70s. I worked in the helmet. We used it at City College for decades. And of course, it's evolved into the 27, 37, 57, 77, 97. And here we are today. So that's the helmet that was chosen by a group of historians, Chris Swan, Leslie included, myself, and a couple others, and figured that it represents the best of the industry evolving from the traditional heavy gear to where we are today for deep water gas diving and bell diving.
And it's still the best hat in use today.
All right.
It sounds like your own show, Kevin, you're talking about that. What I'll add to what Don said is that when we had the meeting in Las Vegas with Paul and Tony, and it looked like it was going to get green light from Kirby Morgan, and we knew that we could get support from the social context we have and inside the industry as well, is that we figured that the permitting process here in Santa Barbara, and you have to, if you haven't been to Santa Barbara or lived in this sort of community where the Reagan ranches, Oprah Winfrey's, the royal family live down the road, getting anything done here takes forever. So we estimated that it would take about 2 years to go through the permitting process of, we're going to have to change this and do that, and someone's going to say it's this and someone's going to say it's something else, and you've got all these committees. And through Don's leadership, along with Mike Wilshire at the waterfront, they got it through in 9 months.
I know, that's just amazing. That boggles my mind right now.
And people ask us, well, you know, do you like bribe people or something? How do you do that? How do you get through that? And so what a little on the negative side is that we weren't geared up to be so successful in that process. We were looking to be where we are now in about a year's time, because it would take that long to get the processes through. So we've been scrambling quite a bit here and in the UK to try and catch up and want to get some of these things running, because we are so far in front of where we estimated it would be because of the permitting process.
Yeah, you know, a lot of credit goes to my wife, Carol, who's been helping us, volunteering. Leslie and I are both volunteers for this project to help get it through. But my wife, being a third-generation Santa Barbara native, knows a lot of people in town, and she helped get us to the right people to discuss this with, coupled with the fact that it is a $500,000 gift to the city of Santa Barbara. How could they possibly turn that down? But we're thrilled to be where we're at right now.
Yeah, that figure is sort of an approximate, because Paul and Tony know more, the process, having successfully done one in for the Navy, is that now we're facing the issue of material supply, which has been going on, as you know, in the economy for a while. Can't determine exactly what supply is going to be and what the prices are going to be. Like the instance with, you have the possible invasion of Taiwan by China. What does that do to the markets? We've got to build some statues. You've got to get some more materials in, and if it goes sky high. So there's some other challenges. It's not as easy as we might make it sound, and it's not all good luck, just the process of going through the permits. There's some serious headaches that we have to look at that we can't control to try and get done. So the idea is to try and get it done as quickly as we can while the prices are where they are.
The cost of commodities constantly fluctuating. Copper, apparently a lot of the resources come from Ukraine, and then the war broke out last year. So this is why, and you know, supply chain shortage, all the things you've been facing during COVID, as you guys know, you know, being down in Long Beach, you see all the ships backed up there.
That was a sight to see, wasn't it?
Yeah,
so many ships.
Huge parking lot.
and so we know this interview isn't normally the sort of guys you'd be interviewing because you're working with active divers, but this monument will reflect the contributions of divers worldwide. It doesn't have Santa Barbara stamped on it. It just happens to be here because we have the proven history of deep water commercial diving expanding here from 62 onwards.
And a friendly city, evidently, that'll push through the paperwork real quick.
We didn't know how friendly. It was a surprise.
We were skeptical to begin with.
So it's probably for your normal audience that are used to divers talking about diving at the time, it's worth looking at this because it'll only go around once here. It's a pretty high-level project. We do have the support of a lot of the industry and a lot of the pioneers as well. So maybe there'll be some other things we can introduce besides Chris Swan's book, but that is the Bible.
It sure is
the Bible. You're absolutely right.
But yeah, so this is not just an oil field diver monument. You know, this is a diving, you know, monument for all divers. I saw a lecture that you had did, Don, and you went through the whole history of the diving and everything. What was the earliest form of diving, just for our audience? I know because I saw a lecture, but
I know too.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. According to some research done by a UCSB anthropologist by the name of Kennedy, the Chumash Indians were really the first divers in Santa Barbara because they found the skulls of some burial sites from Chumash Indians had the presence of exostoses, which are bony growths in the auditory ear canal. So they found these in the skulls of local Chumash, but they never found them up north, up in the Monterey area, because the water is so cold up there. So they surmised from his research, we're talking 8,000 years ago, that the Chumash, they used abalone shells for dishes. They used the iridescence. They made coins, and they actually traded those. That was their money back then. So Kennedy surmised that the first divers, first commercial divers harvesting for resource fisheries, were the Chumash Indians.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So then, there you have it, Gulf. The first commercial divers are in California.
Trying to start a rivalry.
No, because that's like a lot of our audience.
Yeah.
I'm just messing with you guys, right? If you're listening in your cars right now, do not turn this off. This is super important, you know. I just thought that was a great little tidbit for, totally. I love history.
Yeah. In my research for that lecture that you're watching, I surprised myself. I was actually researching abalone because Lad Handelman, the late Lad Handelman, a good friend of ours, he told me that all things diving come back to the abalone. And I never really totally understood what he meant. I knew he was an ab diver. But then as I started to research it, you know, it went way back beyond. And of course, you had the Japanese at the turn of the century introducing the air helmets, you know, from British design over here to California because they were diving for abalone, and the water, of course, was too cold for the ama divers to free dive for them. So they imported the helmets of the British design over here and used them in California. So you had the Japanese, which dominated the abalone diving industry for decades, and then you had World War II break out. And guess what happened during World War II? We took all the Japanese divers and we interned them into camps, which opened a void in the abalone industry, which is where you had your Caucasians entering into the picture then, back around in, you know, the 1940s or so.
Yeah.
And it evolved from there.
And the reason why I wanted to bring it up, because I mean, such a storied diving history here in Santa Barbara. So, you know, there's no better place than a deep water diving monument than here in Santa Barbara. I'm just beating the horse to death. That's all.
Oh. Well, it's true. It's supported by Christopher's research and just sitting down and talking to like Ladd and Radcliffe and Bob Kirby and Bev Morgan and the string of others, Whitey Steffens, and the guys that formed the very early companies. Oceaneering's largest publicly held company is formed out of a bunch of guys that were barely college level educated here. They went through CalDive, and then CalDive joined with Phil Newton's CanDive and formed Oceaneering with worldwide divers out of the Gulf. But there are other companies that were developed at that time, and the equipment was developed as well. The first dive that we recognize that opens this up is a Japanese abalone helmet converted for demand helium. So yeah. And that's in the museum. I think you guys have seen that down there.
Yeah,
that actual helmet from Dan Wilson, you know, he made that demonstration dive in November 3rd, 1962, right out here offshore, east end of Santa Cruz Island, 400 feet, the first commercial use of mixed gas. He substituted helium because he was trained at the Sproling School of Deep Sea Diving.
In Wilmington.
Wilmington. Uh-huh. And E.R. Cross had trained Dan Wilson, and he knew about it, but they never used it. Now, the Navy had been using it, and Wilson, you know, they kept moving from those oil fields just off the cliffs of Summerlin. They had to go out in deeper water, and the continental shelf is, you know, very close to shore, so it gets deep real quick out here.
Yeah.
So soon they were in 200 feet of water, 250 feet of water, and you had guys like Murray Black that were diving on air down to 300 feet.
Like right off of the beach, too.
Yeah. Know? Well,
not exactly, but pretty close.
I'm just exaggerating a little bit.
Well, you look at platform A, B, and C right out here over your shoulder. You look out; those platforms are in 240 feet of water. And platform, you have Hillhouse A, B. The third one in from the left is where the infamous 1969 oil spill started.
Yeah.
Wow! Yeah, we'll definitely take some pictures and share it with our audience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Too bad you guys aren't looking at what I'm looking at. It's beautiful out here.
Take a shot. But Don mentioning Sparling, which is E.R. Cross's school, he picked up and developed that from Joe Sparling. And that's, you correctly say, is in Wilmington. But besides Dan Wilson, Murray Black was trained by Cross. Torrance Parker arrived with diving capabilities from blagging his way into being a 15-year-old. I think it's 15 years old. He gets hired by the Greeks in Tarpon Springs during World War II. I can't remember exactly how it works. Yeah. So all that stuff's in your neck of the woods. And there's quite a few of those Sparling graduates went on to do big things. And we had, when we started the HDS here, we had in, I think it's 1994, I managed to get E.R. Cross to come down from Washington and meet with Charles Isbell and Torrance Parker. And there was one other. Murray Black didn't make that one. But at that time, after we'd started the HDS, about 1994, we did this one reunion. We called it the Sons of Sparling for a conference. And the ADC was really big supporters still then, but you know, Andre Galland, all those guys came, and when you looked at the history books and you went around the table, there were all these like pioneers that started companies or done record dives. Like Wilson and DiveCon, once once Wilson had got moving with General Offshore Divers and the first mixed gas dive, Murray Black starts his own company, DiveCon, and they build the second series of only two helmets on Morse shells, integral canister helmets. He does a working dive from the surface with those hats to 525 feet, not out of a bell. He jumps off the boat with 750 feet of hose, I think it was.
Wow.
To do a working dive in 525 feet. Did a couple of them as well in the Mediterranean. Those helmets are one of them, one of the two is in the museum. So there's a lot of history in there that we will eventually catch up to this being a year in front of where we thought we'd be. And there's a bunch of stuff down there to see. Well, I think you saw them when you came to the reunion.
Yeah.
Yes.
But, you know, for you listeners out there, back to the monument, this is a monument for the entire industry. And, you know, we're well aware and all equally supportive of Rusty's monument down in Morgan City. In fact, we've all donated to that. And we hope that that gets completed just as much as we hope this one gets finished off, which it will. Because it's a testament to everybody's career, and it honors, you know, all of the divers worldwide. So why not have one in Morgan City, one in Santa Barbara, you know, highly visible as far as a tourist town, and educate the public as to when you open up a water faucet, there was a commercial diver involved in that water coming out of there at some point. You know, when you get a package, it came in on a ship. And as you guys service all the time, ships coming into the port of Long Beach. So our industry has never really done a very good job at promoting itself, you know, not like, you know, Hollywood or professional sports or anything. And I personally think it's high time that we do it. And thanks to guys like you that are getting the word out there to the general public and working divers, you know, getting information is key to these monuments succeeding. And
to follow on what Don's saying about the promotion and marketing of it, is I came out of Hollywood and started the retired from there and started the HDS and looked at how to market diving history. And what you're really marketing is a bunch of bubbles, because the public doesn't get to see this at all. And there isn't the accessibility to, like, if you will, the superstars of commercial diving or even in recreational diving, some of the filmmakers, that they don't have managers and agents and that. You'll find them at the bar, or you'll find them at the dive show if you go to Underwater Intervention or some of these places, and you can just walk up to them, basically. There isn't a security guard, this, that, and the other. So in trying to market it, coming out in the background in that, boy, this is really, really difficult, because there isn't any – there's a mystique, but the mystique is under the bubbles. So to follow on what Don said, it is really difficult to market on a general broad basis. But something like this, the monument, at the level it's done, I'm guess you'll be showing the detail of the actual statuettes. You can see this high-end sculpture, fine art, limited edition. And the guy that did it, Greg, is the guy that did the Reagan bust for the Reagan Library. So I think they can afford to choose anyone in the world they want, and they chose him, and we were fortunate enough to get him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the detail that he has in that statuette is just incredible, right down to the buckle on the Miller weight belt. You know, initially I was looking at the buckle, and it wasn't quite ready. Fixed it, turned it around, and you know, We're really happy with the way it turned out. And the 8-foot monument, when it is installed, we'll have an unveiling of it, and all of the owners of the statuette that are purchasing these things to support it, you know, of course, will be invited, as well as general public and everything. It's going to be a big deal that we're all looking forward to.
And like you said, it's a high traffic area. Mm-hmm. You know, people are going to see it.
Yeah.
And the thing about, like you mentioned earlier as well, it's not a very, you know, it's a very sexy job coming out of the water and going in, but then you're just seeing bubbles.
Right.
Right.
It's tough to market.
And you rely on stories, diver stories.
Yeah.
But it's like, how do you get into the story unless you're drinking at a bar? Uh-huh. Now, here we have a monument that people might see, and then, hey, that's, uh-huh. They'd be more likely to listen, to a story or ask questions about what a diver does. And that's a big thing, is asking questions, providing education, because that's how we make changes to our industry, and that's how we get better pay eventually in the future. More people that care about our job, care about us as people, they're more likely to get behind us when legislation needs to be passed, That's my big thing.
And, further to that, Mondo, getting people, younger divers, interested, they love, everybody starts out as a scuba diver these days. And, getting these people to make that transition into commercial diving, if they're interested in working in the water, learning about it and having some useful skills, we need to have a future. We need to have a constant supply. My career, I'm done. I'm retired now. You guys will be retired. You got some shelf life left to you, I'm sure.
Just a little bit. Johnny's got a little more than me.
Yeah.
But we need to get other people to carry the torch. Yep. And, paying attention to it, we plan on having, it's right a few feet away from the Maritime Museum, which you guys have been to, and I'm sure you're going to go down there again. But we're going to have QR codes, and it's going to prompt people. You want to learn more about this? Go into the Maritime Museum and you'll see Dan Wilson's helmet. You will see Bob Kirby and Bev Morgan's helmets in there, which were designed and built in Santa Barbara. You'll see the Purisma diving bell, the world's first commercial lockout bell. Mm-hmm. Right on the patio. We restored that at City College back 2011 and plopped it down on the patio there.
Yeah. What a beautiful museum. We're going to go ahead and take a break. And when we come back from the break, we definitely want to hear a little bit about your personal careers. And we'll have at it. All right, we'll be right back.
Okay.
RentalToolsOnline.com. RTO. They've got you covered with rental tools that can handle the most demanding marine construction jobs and available to ship anywhere in the globe. But don't let the name fool you. They also have new tools and equipment for sale at some of the best prices around with amazing customer service. RTO has a Trustpilot score of 4.9 out of 5 with almost 200 reviews. They're real customers, non-paid, real thoughts. DiveX Marine was impressed by the great inventory. Bill Eubanks at Harbor Diving Service praised the customer support and fast shipping. And John Shaw at Advanced Marine Services says, for a small contractor who needs to rent, RTO is the perfect solution. Quick and painless. Rental Tools Online carries all the major brands like Stanley, Nemo, JW Fisher's, and even Pressure Junkies, to name a few. RTO has their own house brand that meets or exceeds industry standards. It's called Joint Zone. Not the place you used to smoke doobies by the bleachers, but an affordable hydraulic tool and lift bag alternative. Their Joint Zone lift bags are manufactured with a higher puncture resistance and load capacity than many other lift bags on the market. With advanced designs and materials, including optional cold weather coating, you don't have to worry about the next salvage job. So for the most convenient way to rent or purchase tools, go to RentalToolsOnline.com. That's RentalToolsOnline.com. Back to the show.
Yeah, and I'm glad I walked back in on this, because that's part of your background as well, as you were the instructor at Santa Barbara for quite a while, right, Don?
Santa Barbara City College Marine Technology Program. I was there for 30 years and then retired in 2019. Yeah, great program, great colleagues, a lot of fun. I mean, basically, it was my dream job. I did 10 years with International Underwater Contractors. Out here, I started in New York. That's how I got to California. We got a contract out here where Platform Hermosa and Hidalgo are, and I was on the bottom at 900 feet in the Manis submarine doing the spud in for the exploratory wells. And they had a major find in the Santa Maria Basin, and did that for 10 years, ran IUC's West Coast office, and when the industry took a nosedive in 1986, the oil glut, when oil in the Gulf, we were working on and off in the Gulf and out here, oil hit $11 a barrel in 86. And we were cut loose by Conoco. And we were out in Green Canyon doing some really deep stuff. And got woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Hey, Don, they're cutting the rig loose. You got to get your gear off the rig. And I'm like, oh, bummer. Okay, well, we'll get started in the morning. He said, no. Get started right now. So here we were 3 in the morning. And they, I mean, literally, we had conduit and cable run on the, you know, sweet installation. We were cutting it off with a burning torch. They wanted that rig cut loose that day. So we were just, it was a shame. But, you know, that's when I made the transition from oil field work. I was on the advisory board at City College, and position became open, and I knew nothing about teaching. My graduates will tell you that, Don, you still know nothing about teaching. And I applied for it, and I got it. And they were more interested in, you know, industry experience, and you can learn how to teach, you know, as they said, you've been teaching all your life, you know, on the job. You're training tenders. You know, that's what we do as divers. You guys know this. Your subordinates, you train them. And if you train them properly, they're going to make your job easier. So that was how I got started in the teaching. And I loved it. It was a great career.
Yeah. I have my little notes here. I'm paying attention to you. But I have my notes. You
He's not looking at porn or anything like he normally does.
You completely redesigned the academic structure there. And you, I mean, to meet that higher demand of the higher demand education, and you made an already tremendous program like even more exemplary. Like, it's kind of a big deal.
Yeah. Thanks, Johnny, for that. We did. It was 1996. You know, the Marine Tech program it started in 1968, as Leslie was mentioning earlier, as a result of Wilson's dive. The Santa Barbara helium rush, you know, exploded from 1962. And all of a sudden, there were just a handful of divers, you know, abalone divers. And, you know, worldwide, they projected, hey, now that we can dive deep, we're going to need 5,000 divers. Where are all these divers going to come from? So Ramsey Park started this Marine Tech program in 68.
Yeah.
But it used to be a two-year associate degree program. 2 years is a long time for somebody to come that has a bachelor's degree and, you know, pay rent in Santa Barbara. So we got together and we decided, hey, a lot of these people, they just want to go to work. They don't want an AS degree. They have a bachelor's degree or you know, they want to get their certification card, which we implemented around the same time with ACDE, and they just want to go to work. So we redesigned the program in 1996. To get through in 2 semesters, and that still exists to this day. So
yeah, and to go back into your diving career with IUC, did you know that you were making those 2 record dives at the time? Like, did it hit you at all?
No idea.
No idea.
No idea.
No idea.
And we were in Viasa Knoll. And, you know, Conoco was like, okay, we're moving the rig and we're spudding in here. Get on bottom, get ready to stab in the drill bit you know, which we did. And then we made a series of dives, 1,972 feet, I think it was. And of course, you know, this is back in the days of telexes, and telex back to New York and tell them that, you know, okay, we completed so many dives today, you know, and here's the depths. And then they were like, whoa, this is the deepest dive for an atmospheric diving suit. You just broke the WASP's record that Oceaneering had. And I was like, great. Do I get anything extra?
You get a t-shirt.
Do I get extra pay? Yeah. So, no, I had no idea, Johnny, at the time.
So you didn't get the $2 a foot.
No,
apparently not. We're not doing depth pay with ADSs. I wish they were, because I'd be a gazillionaire by now. But
So that's the downfall with diving.
Right.
Right. For your depth is 1 foot or whatever.
Yeah. They used Oceaneering used to give depth pay in the WASP. in the early days.
Until they learn better.
Yeah, right. But yeah, the Mana sub was it was basically designed by OSEL, Offshore Systems Engineering Limited, in Great Yarmouth, England. And I went over there for training with it. Got trained up. I'm, you know, a 20-something-year-old kid, you know, just wide-eyed. And, oh, you know, next thing we know, we're shipped off to the Gulf and plopping on a rig. Penrod 75 was the first deepwater rig that I worked on. We also worked on Discover Seven Seas over in Marseille, France, with the Pisces submersible. And we did diving work as well. But most of it was just to fold in the arms of the BOP when it was coming up to the moon pool. So very, very simple stuff there, cleaning out sea chests and stuff. But most of the work was deep water drilling support. And that was our forte at the time.
What a job for a 20-year-old. God. You know, like I got into it when I was like around 24. And wow, 20. Like I was a totally different person from my 20s to my mid-20s, you know.
Yeah, it's they're productive years for sure. Yeah.
God. You also did a lot of Florida State, though. You were also at Florida State for a while, weren't you?
Well, Florida Institute of Technology was where I got my training, which they shut down in, I think, 1986. But, FIT was they have a lot of divers that are still working in the business right now.
And also recreation, because Drew Richardson, head of PADI, is FIT. Tom Ingram, FIT, DEMA.
Tom was a year after me. But Drew was an assistant instructor. This is the head of PADI. He was an assistant instructor in the scuba program when we started scuba training there, because they did scuba work too. And I remember Drew well. He was just a couple years older than me. And like I said, we were bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and had a lot of fun.
Good stuff.
That's awesome. So then you settle down, you start your family, you work at SBCC, you retire, but you're also the what do we got here? The oh my gosh, the board of directors of the Association of Commercial Diving Educators.
Yeah, no longer.
I
stopped that when I retired. Actually, we stopped. City College stopped the ACD membership, 2018. It was basically kind of cratering. A lot of politics involved and stuff. And you know, we just got basically tired of all the infighting and stuff, because we're there a lot different than the City College is state funded. It's a community college. So we're all in it to train the divers to benefit the industry. Whereas, you know, not to diss private schools, but they're in the business to make money.
Yeah.
And
there's not many private schools left.
No, there's not.
It's been a bad time for schools.
Divers Academy recently just closed down. You know, Tammy, she had a tough go.
She's still in jail.
Yeah, I believe so.
When she gets out, hopefully we'll be able to talk to her. So, Tammy, if you're listening from prison, what do you come on the Bottom Dwellers Dive Show?
Well, there's all the infighting, as I mentioned, you know, and then all of the politics was the key reason we decided, because we want to focus on getting our divers out into the field. And that's where, you know, we still issue the ADC card, which is really what, you know, you guys know when you get a new guy on your crew, you have your ADC card, and that's all that's important.
Yep.
So, but yeah, we had a good run there. We worked, you know, when John Schwitters from College of Ocean Air, and he bought the school years ago. He was there for a short period of time, but he was Dutch and a very astute businessman, and he brought ACD to the next level, and that's when we wrote the ANSI standard. And we started issuing certification cards, entry-level diver, commercial diver certification cards, entry-level. And that's long before ADCI started issuing commercial diver certification cards. So it was around that time that, you know, people are interested in plastic cards. You know, we're interested in training quality divers, mm-hmm. not issuing plastic cards all over the place.
Well, because a lot of times you didn't even need to go to a dive school to be a diver back in the early days. You know, there's several stories about divers mm-hmm. getting their start in bars. Oh, yeah. You know, just happened to be drinking with another diver, said, hey, I need a tender. Yep. You want to come? I'm like, yeah, sure. I'm not doing nothing.
Yeah,
next thing you know, they're a diving legend.
Yeah,
if you feel triple fours on the hose here, pull me up quick.
Right.
Yeah, it used to be here in Santa Barbara back in the 60s. You know, you're literally pulling your tenders out of the bar.
Yeah,
and these were fishery divers, abalone divers, and they were used to working at sea in harsh environments. And they were used to fixing anything that broke. When you're out, you know, 26 miles offshore at Santa Cruz Island diving for abalone and your compressor goes down, you know, you're going to get some baling wire and bubble gum and fix a damn thing. You're not going to go to an offshore hardware store.
You're not going to wait for the mechanic to come out and take a look at her. It's too funny. Man, so we wanted to talk a little bit about Leslie as well. You said did some stuff with Hollywood. Most of your background is scuba background, right?
Yeah, my diving experience is through recreational diving. And I learned to dive in Singapore in 1969 through the British Sub-Aqua Club system. And I ended up becoming the diving officer for the special British Sub-Aqua Club branch there. And so I don't have any credentials in commercial diving. Well, if you want to, the Hollywood thing was I had my own band in England, wasn't very successful, to put it mildly. and so I'd always had an interest in music, particularly American music. And I came to America. I started working in Hollywood on the club circuit, recruiting baby bands and doing their promotion. There was no money in it. It was just gaining the experience. And eventually went through, got one of the baby bands signed at the same time as Bon Jovi signed to Mercury. They signed my band. Bon Jovi went one way and my guys went another way. But at that time, I'd come to the attention. I was a manager. I didn't have a big repertoire of artists to manage. But I'd come to the attention of some of the producers. And so one of them was Al Cooper. That's Al Cooper with a K. And Al founded Blood, Sweat, and Tears, discovered Lynyrd Skynyrd, cut Free Bird, cut Sweet Home Alabama, was Bob Dylan's band leader, played keyboards on like a Rolling Stone, mm-hmm. worked with The Who, Hendrix. And so Al knew everyone. And I started to work with him. We sort of became friends. We'd both been involved with this band at Polygram, at the Mercury. And from working with Al, I went through, we did some TV work for Michael Mann after he'd done Miami Vice. He did Crime Story. Oh, and cool. So we worked on that. And when we were doing Crime Story, I got to meet a young producer in Amigo Studios in Hollywood. And it's a long story, but the young producer ends up being Mike Klink, and he has Guns N' Roses, and he pulls me into them. So I stayed with Michael and did Guns N' Roses, Metallica, Whitesnake. I'd done B.B. King with Al when we were working together. And then the last album I did was Guns N' Roses, Use Your Illusion, the double album. And I don't think anyone stayed after that album was done because we were on tour without the album being in the store. So it was, and then we were touring with Metallica as well. So there was a connection between the two bands. But during that period, I'd bought this diving helmet in England and couldn't find anything about it. It was old and the amount of patina on it. And I wanted to find out more about this helmet and I was going to sell it. To raise some money to do some demo recordings. And when I wasn't in the studio with the band, I'd sort of seeded all the bookshops in Hollywood to save diving books for me because I was interested in trying to research some things and interested in diving. And in one of these books one of these boxes they saved for me was Bob Martin's book, The Deep Sea Diver, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, which is based around, I think it's Highline College that Bob did the book based around. And in it is a picture of this helmet, an Augustus Seebee helmet, the first real manufacturer.
Love that helmet.
And so I thought, well, maybe I should hang on to this. And from that, I wanted to find out more, and that got me interested in diving history. And I started to collect equipment. I'd already been collecting books and magazines and ephemera, which leads me into founding the HDS here in the States, co-founding, actually. The Historical Diving Society was formed in England in 1990, and I was the first American member. I lived here in the States, but I heard about them and I joined them and became the first American member in it. And then they asked me if I'd start a sort of chapter over here. And I didn't have any connections to the industry, but because I'd collected equipment, I had got this one helium recirculator that had been stripped out. And I knew Kirby Morgan had something to do with it. It just had a Desco plaque on it, but I knew enough about the history of mixed gas. So I came up here. At that time, I lived in Malibu. I came up to Garden Street to see Kirby Morgan to see if they have the spares for it. And that's where I met Skip Dunham, who was the president. They didn't have the equipment because it was old stuff. And he sent me over to meet Bob Kirby because Kirby had built this helmet. And so from when I got the opportunity to start an organized structure here for diving history, I didn't know anyone, but Skip and I had become quite friendly, and Kirby and I had become quite friendly. And so Skip said he'd help me. So we sort of co-founded the HDS. We did it at City College with Don Spores, with Mike von Alvensleben. And that was my entry in. And it's membership based. So in a country this size, the only thing we could hold it together was with like a magazine. And mm-hmm. so started to, this is Don's issue here of the helium rush. And so it produced, was then called the Historical Diver Magazine. And then I started just working the shows and doing the circuit and going round and round and round. And it covers recreational and commercial and military. And that's the other thing about the monument. We've spoken specifically about really the commercial part of it because it's your show on commercial. There's a military element to it, those helmets as well. And when you look at the development of mixed gas diving and you refer it into the military, the Kirby Morgan equipment, a lot of the stuff was in under the Official Secrets Act. So you can get it, but there's been some declassification of Operation Ivy Bells, which is where you can't get anyone to tell you face-to-face what went on, but they're living using Kirby Morgan gear on that phone line in Russia in the submarine. That's all Kirby Morgan stuff. Wow. And so, C-Lab, the third C-Lab, they were doing, I think, 600 feet out here on Kirby Morgan gear, all that stuff. But that's not classified. You can find that in books. But some of this, what Bev would call the Sneaky Pete stuff, you can't go in there, Leslie. It's Sneaky Pete. Oh, come on, I'll show you. You know, I don't want to see it. I don't want to know about it. I'll read about it, you know. So
you're talking about the halibut dive.
The halibut, yeah. But I mean,
Paul Linewood was on there, and Jack Reedy from Caldive.
When you look at that monument, it's not just the commercial guys. There's a military element to it too. A lot of it's recorded, but the real mixed gas where they're living down there. They had an octopus set up home under, remember, the submarine. That long, an octopus built a home around the submarine. Yeah.
That's so cool.
We were on there. They had these listening devices that they would clamp onto the cable, and they were getting all the Soviet communications. This was back during the Cold War, of course. Yeah. And they were listening to that, and they did it for a very, very long time, but it was highly classified.
The book is Blind Man's Bluff by Sherry Sontag. It's got sections in it, and Craven did a little bit on it, but most of it is... But these guys, you seem to have a pretty good following of people that sit in bars and talk about diving. If you bump into one of these guys, used to be, was it a horse and cow or horse and bar up north? You once in a while, you get someone might open up about that was on it. And there's some interesting stuff. Anyway, we were talking about the monument. So.
Yeah. And that's kind of what we wanted to talk with you about too, is that we knew when we were going to have you on that you weren't a commercial diver. You know, it was recreational, mostly background, you know, that you had done. But we also wanted to stress the importance that, you know, you don't have to be a commercial diver to, you know, be interested in what we do and to help us out.
Yeah.
Because we know a lot of divers, you know, once they get older, they start, you know, collecting, then they get into the history like us. But the vast majority of the young divers, they don't care, you know. Yeah. And we're hoping to change that a little bit. And it's organizations like the Historical Dive Society that's going to help with that. So hopefully, you know, in the near future, work together, do some events. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it'd be awesome to try to get the youth interested.
Yeah, it's still living in the shadow of when you do the transfer from the classic helmets, from like Augustus Seebee helmets. The design is 1840. And it isn't until you come into the 60s that you start getting the lightweight gear come in different areas. Savoy out of the Gulf seems to be the leader at the time there, but he's using Italian motorcycle helmets.
Yeah,
that he's converting. Cool.
Hey, yeah. Is that one right there? Right, that's a Savoy right there. I knew it. Okay.
And then there's others that develop, and then in the you know, Miller comes in a little later on, but there's also Swindell and stuff. But Kirby Morgan ended up being the dominant player in it, and we're still in that period. Kirby Morgan doesn't form until 1960. They meet in 65. They form in 66, and they're still working on masks and using recirculators, and you can see the future coming. That Purisma bell that's down at the Santa Barbara Maritime Museum, that's what Don led that project to bring that back, and that's what drives people out of the commercial metal helmets, copper and brass traditional ones, into the lightweight swim gear. That whole period there is, because that changes it, it hadn't changed in 150 years. 160 years, I guess.
You know, I was asked a question. We were down in the harbor a couple weeks ago, and I ran into Bob Benton's son or nephew. Anyway, he had heard about the monument project, and he's seen pictures of it, and I think he might have seen the statuette up in the harbor master's office. But he asked, he said, how come you guys did not do this with the heavy gear helmets? And I said, well, you know, we talked long and hard about that with Chris Swan, Leslie, and we went back and forth. What is the most significant historical factor of Santa Barbara? Is the development of lightweight diving gear. An interesting story how that evolves was, you know, Dan Wilson, They were doing surface gas jumps using this helmet right here, the Japanese helmet, surface gas jumps down below 400 feet. You know, that's crazy today. That just doesn't exist. So they needed a way to, you know, protect the diver, and that's when Wilson designed the Purisma. Well, when he designed the Purisma, and a lot of folks are not aware of this, but it's in Chris's book, when he designed the hatch for the Purisma, I think it was 18 inches in diameter. It's a very small hatch. Believe me, I've been in there several times and I could barely fit through my waist. Imagine a guy with heavy gear trying to, and there's all kinds of stories about Murray Black designing a twist off device inside to get the helmet off. But that's when Wilson enlisted people like Bob Christensen, most understated diver, in my opinion, in the history of diving. He was taught at Santa Barbara City College for years. But Bob Christensen, Bob Ratcliffe, all worked for Dan Wilson, and Bev Morgan did too. And Dan said, hey, you guys, we need to have a, you know, more functional piece of gear, lighter weight piece of gear. And Bev is like, hey, abalone divers down in Newport Beach have been diving with these white off masks, so let's start with that. And then Ratcliffe got involved, and they started tweaking things. And then that's when Bev met Kirby, and they went off and they designed band masks, which evolved into superlights. And that's really the history of it that people weren't aware of, because lightweight gear probably wouldn't have evolved if it hadn't been for the albatross of the Purisma when it was designed. It was, you know, bulky, dual spear. The buoyancy, center of buoyancy was way below this the center of gravity. So when they put the bell in the water for the very first time, they launched it in Santa Barbara Harbor, dual spear, and no flotation on it. Okay. So then they had to put a big flotation spear up top, and they had to put weights down below on the bottom. And so pretty soon you have a 30-foot-tall device that you have to launch and recover. Whitey Steffens you know, he lived up here on the Mesa. I interviewed him years ago, and he told me that that thing was a nightmare to launch and recover. It was swinging around on the barges they had out here. It only did a handful of dives, and then it went to back up to Union Carbide in Tonawanda, New York, and they use it as a test chamber. But I never, as a young diver, I never had an appreciation for the history. You know, Dan Wilson, his historic gas dive in 62, when I was a young kid in dive school, you know, writing notes, and I heard, this year's the history. Okay, Dan Wilson, I have my old notes still. And I was like, son of a gun. You know, here we are 40 years later, and now I'm interested in Dan Wilson. The Prisma diving bell, after it went to Tonawanda, Andre Galern bought it to use in dive school at City Island, New York, at professional diving school in New York. When I worked there, we used to go outside and we'd have to take a leak rather than walk all the way into the office building where the bathrooms were. We'd step outside the shed and go take a leak on the Prisma. And I never realized that here I am peeing on a piece of history. So, but here we are.
This is the leadership we've been looking for in diving history.
It's true though. Yeah, when you're a young diver, you just want to get out there for the adventure. Yeah,
exactly.
You know, damn the history. You
what,
know,
what is this thing?
Who cares about that? Some old fogies.
That's, you know, the Prisma.
Yeah.
Go pee on it.
So it's in that, but going back to that transfer of from 160 years of heavy gear into light gear, there isn't a book on Kirby Morgan, and I think just by the nature of the stuff they did that was secret, Bev was very, very private, very, very private. Bev had a lot of the knowledge. And so I interviewed him and Kirby about the development of the company, but only for the magazine. And so this is around, it's three parts, the history of Kirby Morgan. So this is issue number 32, and then 33 and 34 are the other two parts to it. And that shows you that company's development, which becomes the major world player in providing that equipment. For this, for mixed gas, this is what you saw in the Maritime Museum. There's a selection of, I think, six helmets here, including a copy of Wilson's first one. They start using these demand helmets, and they go into helium here. But now we're doing this on with Kirby Morgan, diving into history. Okay. And so there's quite a few of these here, which is also on YouTube.
I really do love those videos they put up, diving into history. They're they're fun little videos. Yeah.
Some of it's true.
At least that's what they tell you, right?
Yeah, we don't have a Prisma to wee on, but that's just...
Oh, man.
And Leslie, you're not a commercial diver, but you're still a diver.
Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of a scuba legend. You're in the Hall of Fame. You led countless of expeditions in the China Sea, the South Chinese Sea. You dove for a king in Jordan. You established...
But you know you're being modest.
Yeah. For everybody, he's being extremely modest. He established a diving center in China Sea. Like, you're kind of a big deal too, you know. You know,
it was some of that's... You know,
something's true.
Something that's true. You know, I did work for His Majesty for a while in Jordan, looking to establish. There was a dive center in Israel run by a German, run by a guy called Willie Halbert, and the Jordanian ministry felt that they had the potential to do one, and so I did do that. I led a few expeditions in the South China Sea from 69 through to 71. And done some of the other things as well. But for me, it's always been like the adventure. And that was, I grew up in East London after the Second World War. So, you know, it was pretty tough going, working class. And there wasn't anything like a chance to go dive or anything like that. So I was in the British military, I was in the Air Force. The perfect unit to join if you want to go diving is the Air Force. You have to make the world what you want it to be sometimes. So for me, I got involved in diving there, and that changed my life. As soon as I was in tropical seas, you could see underwater. It's like, wow, this is really interesting. And for me, it was fairly easy to do. And so it changed my whole direction. My two passions have been music and diving, and so the Crossroads album is Diver Down by Van Halen. And so we often wear a pin from that, the 1984 tour, which is the Diver Down tour.
Yeah.
And so there is a big crossover and passion between the two, modern music. And it used to be more traditional American R&B and soul and blues. I worked for BB on an album with Al Cooper. So cool. And that was like the nicest guy I ever met in Hollywood was BB awesome. King. Just an amazing guy to hang out with. It's like the uncle you wish you had. He was just fantastic, great guy. And we did a couple of shows together and stuff. But so yeah, some of the recreational thing is it's a lot of it. Hadaman explained it to me once about the HDS and why it hadn't been done before. Because Leslie, you're a lot dumber than you look, you know. And this is because the American guys looked at this and figured out you couldn't make any money. So they didn't. But you're so dumb. You come in and you look at it and go, oh, yeah, no one's ever done this. You haven't thought about the money, have you? No. Okay. That's why you're going to do okay at it, because you're willing to do it for no money. And that was Hadaman's, the guy that founded Ocean Hearing. And he was street level as well. Like I mentioned in his Celebration of Life, we used to compare our backgrounds, mine in East London and lads in New York, and he always had the worst stories about being brought up than I did, except for one. And the one I could beat him with was I went to school in girls' clothing one day, and he couldn't beat that. Jesus, Leslie, you know, how do you do? Well, just that's how it was for that day, you know, his girls' clothing. And he loved the story because I had a girl's name, Leslie. And he knew the story. So he'd introduce me to people and say, Leslie, so come here. Tell them about when you're dressed as a girl. That was his introduction for me to several people. But
it's a great introduction. Yeah, yeah.
Here's my friend. He used to call me Lord Leslie because of the English thing.
Yeah, he actually had people. When Laddie introduced him to people, he would introduce him as, this guy is a real British lord.
Before, you didn't tell me that when I was outside the room.
Referred to him as Lord Leslie. And so whenever Lord Leslie, everybody knew him, he'd be looking around the room kind of smirking.
Yes, or, my lord.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you'd go in and I'd go into these, you know, walk in and see him and he'd have a meeting and walk in, and I didn't know anything about it. He'd told him, look, you know, he comes in, he's a real lord, he's casually dressed. Now, it's like culture is like the royal family. You can't speak to him. He has to speak first, and then you answer him. That's all. And so I walk into these rooms where he's like the boys and girls club meetings. Would, oh, come in, Lord Leslie. And so people stand up. very polite people. Well, thank you. Good. And then it'd be this total silence. Yeah. Oh, maybe I've said something. I've done something right there. And they're all waiting for me to speak. They won't speak to me. And we end up that that story ends up in your realm, in the Irish pub, James Joyce on State Street. And I walk in there one Sunday night for the Irish music, and there's people on bar stools. And I walk through the door. And as I walk up to the people on the bar stools, start getting up and say, where, what's going on? And then they tell, you know, they tell me the story.
How long did it go on?
Oh, maybe like a year or so. It wasn't every week or anything like that. Right.
Pretty funny.
You know, I said, no, I'm not a real lord. And you know, I'm just, he said, yeah, he told us you'd deny it. He had set them up pretty good.
We'd have these gatherings up at Lad's head up the hill here. And yeah, you saw some new people here. And Laddie would tell them the story. This is Lord Leslie Laney coming in the door. You refer to him as Lord Leslie.
and he would do it all the time. So, and he'd like, because he'd been in a wheelchair, Lord Leslie, come in. How are you today? And I didn't pay any attention to it. Just it like him, because he's like, he'd do crazy stuff with it. And then it'll be, oh my.
Oh, yeah. He was a character.
Man, I really wish we got a chance to talk to him, meet him. Yeah.
Like I said, it's a celebration. He's not the biggest liar I ever met, just the best.
That's awesome.
Nice. He was very interested in young divers. You know, when I was teaching at City College, I would always take my students up to his house. And I'd actually hold my class up there. And you're talking with one of the original gas diving pioneers with General Offshore. Now, I have 30 students in his house sitting down. I'd buy them lunch and we'd sit down. When he started to talk, you could hear a pin drop in that room. Even the, you know, you've got your assortment of divers. You've got your A students, people that you know are going to go to work. And then you have your wastoids that kind of sit in the back. Even the wastoids would be perking up and listening. And, you know, it was pretty significant. You know, we're not going to have that anymore, you know. You know, these pioneers that are here. And that's why, you know, back to this thing, that's why we're doing it, is to honor the legacy of all the people that built this industry from California to the Gulf of Mexico to the, you know, Navy, the U.S. Navy.
Worldwide.
Yeah. And that's why we're having this podcast, to speak to guys like you.
It is, it's strange because, you know, in looking at it, that we were friends with many of these guys. Not all of them are easy to approach, but what happens, most of them have passed on now, and sort of it's left to us, those of us that have an interest in it here. And there's several of us, not just Don and I, Chris, of course, a leader in it. And you've sort of become the disciples of these stories. Mm-hmm. But it's not our stories. You pass them on. And so get them in print. The books are, that's a 25-year project.
Yeah.
Just that book, 25 years. These are quarterly. And so, and they're a blend of recreational, commercial, and military. So at least we get it into print. And one of the things in doing this, going back to lads saying, you know, you're crazy because you can't make any money at it, is that we're on issue number 114 now. And in that period, they've only had three letters of correction in 114 issues in 30 years. So the level of accuracy of the columnists and because there's always someone out there knows a little bit more about that particular helmet or that particular regulator or this particular piece of equipment. Done very well with the standards, and that's what's attracted a lot of these pioneers, that you're going to be well represented. You're not going to be just abused or misled. It's going to be accurate.
That's the thing about Chris's book, you know, 25 years worth of research. But if you look in the glossary of that, every single fact or historical figure has been interviewed in that book. Mm-hmm. And he has the audio tapes of it, and it's all referenced in there. So none of it's BS. You know, when I started reading that, you know, I had heard when I was in dive school for years, there was back in the 60s, you know, Dan Wilson, he had done his gas dive, and General Offshore was doing their work out here off Santa Barbara, and they were on bottom, and Danny was making the dive, and he had a O2 hit on the bottom, and diver who happened to be Whitey Steffens jumped in, went down his hose, brought him up to his first stop. He was unconscious. He ventilated the helmet, brought him up to his first stop, and then he came to. He was blue in the face. Then he came to, and then he just panicked and bolted to the surface, exposed to the decompression sickness. They got him in the chamber. He lived. Laddie was in the chamber. They got him treated, lining river flew out. Everything turned out good. The gas was improperly mixed. He was diving 18%, and apparently they improperly mixed the gas, not because they bought it from a gas company before they were doing their own mixing. And he was diving, I think, 21%. And that mere difference was enough to bring on the O2 hit. But I had heard that story when I was in dive school. And then when I was in the field, you know, oh yeah, my instructor did this and my brother-in-law was the guy that rescued them, and never knew the truth about it until Chris came out with his book. And I went up to Whitey's house and I sat down and interviewed him about that incident. And Whitey was tough as nails diver, very humble. And I asked him about that dive. It took me about 2 hours to get him out to tell the story. Oh, wow. But he eventually told it to me, and you know, I got it on tape and got it on video. It's up on YouTube somewhere. And I'm very proud of that. The fact that, you know, we discovered that information and it's factually accurate thanks to Chris's work. Everything in that book is backed up and authentic. And you can see all the stickies on there from when I was back in my teaching days doing all the facts and figures on different historical aspects. But, you know, back, Leslie will never tell you this, you know, that there's no, you know, he jokes that there's no money to be made in the diving history and stuff. And that may or may not be true. But the one thing that has kept the HDS going for 30 plus years now is the passion of this gentleman right here. And that passion kind of spreads like wildfire to guys like me. You know, when I first met Leslie, I didn't know HDS from Adam. And then I slowly got interested in it. And, you know, here we are today. He's one of my closest friends, and we're working together on this project. And it's a real honor to work with Leslie and share that passion. And hopefully that's going to spread like wildfire with the divers that are out in the field. I know these statuettes are very pricey to buy. And you know, it's not a... something that I take, like even my kids have bought one of these because they grew up here. They know the history of diving. They've heard all the stories and stuff from, you know, back in my teaching days. But we're very optimistic that this is going to stand as a legacy project here in Santa Barbara that honors the entire industry.
Yeah. And that's true. It will do that. And it's not a cheap undertaking, but it's a gift to the city. So that's partly why we were able to get through the process so quickly of the permits. So, when you look at what other things cost, it's cheaper than some of the other things involved in diving, but partly a simple view of it for mine. If it's good enough for Ronald Reagan's library, that level of sculptor, it's good enough for what we want to do. We'll always take the best.
And, you know, speaking from the business approach, you know, we discussed this with Paul and Tony, and the funding model that they use for this, very similar, identical to the one they use down in Panama City at the Naval School of Deep Sea Diving, is you give them a 22-inch version. That thing there weighs 40 pounds. You pick it up, it's damn heavy. Wow. Rather than going out and just holding your hand out, hey, give me a donation, we want to build a monument, you know, in Santa Barbara, and, you know, give me what you can. And it would take years and years and years. Whereas here, yeah, give us a donation and we're going to take, you know, that thing is very expensive to make. It's about $3,000+ to do by the time we're said and done with it, maybe more now, who knows. But they at least have something. It's identical to the
Mark V ones are sort of family assets now for the military, and this is optional for military and commercial. And it's we've seen that the Mark V monuments one just came up for auction. Not many; they don't come up very often. They're very, very, very difficult to find. 300 of them.
Run, right? You've only got so many in the world.
Yeah, and so trying to get one on the used market. There's one come up the other day, and it was 5,002, I think, which was, I thought, was a good buy.
Well, you know, at the time, it's funny because I had considered, you know, it's back in my teaching days, you know, you don't have, at the time, they were $3,000 back in 2011, I think it was. And I was like, I really want to get one of these. These are really cool, you know. It'd be great to have, you know, I have the helmet here. But gosh, it would be great to have one of those. And I kick myself now for not throwing down. You know, of course, inflation has kicked the prices on these things. But so 300 limited edition, and that's it. They'll be gone and done.
So hurry up and get them.
Yeah,
pull your money together. We can keep it at each other's houses. We'll go year by year, Johnny. Let's go to the other house.
Sure.
Well, I'll have it odd years. You have it even years.
It's interesting, you know, because I totally agree with you guys. $5,000 is a lot of money to throw down for us. But they do actually have payment plans that Paul and Tony are doing for this.
Okay, yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they have payment plans where you can pay in pieces. I don't know exactly what that entails, but you know, my involvement on that one there is actually the first one that came out. I wanted to get number 17, which that's actually the first one.
So cool.
But I wanted 17 because it's Super Light 17.
Yeah, so best hat in the world.
Yeah. Johnny's smirking at you.
it's a ruddy joke.
27 is the best hat in the world.
Are you a desk old guy? Or
no, Gorski I'm a 27 guy.
Okay.
Oh, well, I do love my Gorskis though. Yeah.
It's funny. We started this project. It's just a quick story. Bob Kirby, the late Bob Kirby, passed away in June. Leslie was over in England. Very good friend of both of ours. And we knew that, you know, Bob had some health issues for quite a while. And I got a call. You know, we had started this project and we were keeping everything under wraps until we were ready to go to this and get the final approval with the city of this. And we're about midway through. We're still in the process in June. We're feeling really good about it, that it's going to go through. And I get a call from Troy, Bob's son. And he says, Don, he says, dad's not going to, he's not going to be here much longer. We've started, you know, hospice and stuff. If you want to come say goodbye, now's the time. So, you know, Bob lives, well, Claudia still lives down in Carpinteria. So Carol and I, we went down there and I talked to Leslie. He's over in England. Of course, he can't come back. And Leslie said, Don, we need to tell him about the project. And I was like, okay.
Because we haven't told anyone else.
We hadn't told anyone else.
It's a non-disclosure between the four of us.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, we got this under wraps. And I'm like, okay. So we go down to Carpinteria, Carol and I, and Claudia and Troy are there. And, you know, Bob is in the living room. In a hospital bed, and you know, Troy said, hey, he's sleeping, he's got the morphine going. And I've been through this before with my father-in-law, and I knew that they can hear while their things are going on. So I go up to Bob and I start talking, hey, Bob, it's Don, you know, I'm here, and I just wanted to let you know about something that Leslie and I are working on. And I explained to him, because he was well familiar with the Mark V project that was done years ago down at the Navy base. And I said, we're doing a monument in Santa Barbara, and it's going to have the Super Light 17, and it's going to have the original toilet seat neck dam on there that you designed. And his eyes are closed, and he opens his eyes. He looks up at me. And he smiles, and then he closes his eyes, goes back to sleep. We leave. That was 11 o'clock in the morning, and he died 12 hours later. So that's something I feel really good about. And that made me feel, you know, that we're doing this for a reason, to honor. Here's an individual that really revolutionized commercial diving along with Deb Morgan. You know, diving is not the same as it was back in the 60s, thanks to these two, which are, you know, they're a part of a very, very big picture that evolved in commercial diving history. And that I feel really good about. Yeah. And when this actual monument goes up, when these 300 statuettes are sold, we're going to celebrate. We're going to celebrate all these individuals in the entire industry.
Yeah. And for your viewers that are out there, we expect we'll have these at the scuba show this year, the HDS booth, probably. It hasn't been decided yet. So if you wanted to see one on public display, it'll be at the Long Beach Scuba Show. Yes. And then I expect that we'll be at Underwater Intervention this year, part of the workboat show in New Orleans in the last day of November, first two of December.
We're going to be there, so.
Oh, well, okay, good.
And the Long Beach Scuba Show.
And the Long Beach Scuba Show. Didn't go last year because I had COVID again for the second time.
Oh.
Just terrible.
Riddled with COVID.
Yeah, it's all over my body. But no, this is an important, you know, monument to get out there. Just like you said, you know, it's honoring those, you know, that came before us, because without them, I wouldn't be doing what I do now.
Yeah.
You know,
and you'll run into that thing all the time, that to try and market it, it's really, 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 really difficult. Part of the easier marketing is how we built the membership base for the society is in the collectors. I have an auction section in each of the journals. There are other countries that have journals that put them out on, to do their own sort of history, their own, but they don't do much on auction work. The auction is where most of the historians are grown, are out of the collector's market. Like, I have this helmet, I want to find more about it. That's what started me. Mm-hmm. Broader in the recreational, because it's more recreational divers. They made, you know, 100,000 regulators a year of these different models. But trying to market it is difficult. But in the collector's field, like John over, you've interviewed over at Catalina, John Council, I mean, did a great job and a great place as well.
Well, we're definitely excited, you know, to see this project come into fruition. And we can't wait until it's up there in Santa Barbara, right there by the marina next to the Historical Dive Society. And Maritime Museum.
Exactly, yeah.
And it's going to be amazing. Is there any other plugs that you guys want to let us know about? Like, where do we go to get a statuette and all that?
You order the statuettes through the website, and it's deepwaterdivingmonument.com, deepwaterdivingmonument.com. And there's on the drop-down menu, there's a order a statuette. And it tells, there's actually resources up there. There's videos, why Santa Barbara, and you click on that drop-down menu, and you can order, you can do bank transfer, you can do credit card, you know, although they charge, I think, Paul and Tony a fee with that. But, you can, these things, they take like 8 weeks to cast and make down at the foundry, and then they're shipped direct. And we've delivered, oh gosh, this month I think there's been 20. So they're starting to come out. You know, I got mine in August. That was the first one that came out of the foundry along with the artist proof. And so now they're starting to come out. I think we're up to over 60 now or so. So they are moving quickly. Again, they are pricey. I totally get that, but they do have payment plans. And, you know, once those 300 are gone, you'll actually get the broken up pieces of the mold. You get a challenge coin, which has the Prisma and the Kirby gas hat on there, as well as the Super Light on the front and back. You can hear it's right up here.
Well, Donzo, I'll just say that all this is American made.
Yeah,
this is right, all domestic market.
Right down in LA is where the foundry's at, and it's a Greg Poltanovich lives down in Simi. So yeah, that's the site where you go to order. And you know, like I said earlier, commodity prices are increasing. They just had a price increase, and I think they've passed that on now. I don't know. I think they're $5,500 now.
I think, yeah, 55.
So if you guys are on the fence about it out there, and gals, you know, thinking about it, act now, get locked in, and then you can do payment plans or whatever, or just throw it down. But I've had a lot of fellow divers. I've had graduates. I even had a City College student purchase one. And my colleagues at City College, the college itself has bought one. Both Dan and Jeff have bought one too.
And if it follows the pattern of what we did with the U.S. Navy, that there were four price rises in the period that we were selling the Mark V monument, again, down to commodity. You can't control it. And if, like I mentioned, if China goes into Taiwan, then who knows? So the quicker we sell these, the better, the cheaper they're going to be, I feel.
Yeah, yeah. This is, you know, again, it's fine art. It's, you know, I heard a story from one of the artists down at the foundry. They were doing elephants for some, say, the elephant group or something like that. They did an elephant about yay big. $28,000 is what it cost.
God.
You know, it was a fundraiser for the elephant group, but...
Yeah, like in the market of these, it's fine art. We're in the diver's market. But it's a statuette, so it's a fine art limited edition. In the studios and the galleries, who was it? Someone said they should sell for like about 15 or 18, I think. If they had it in the gallery, took it on consignment, they'd ask 15 to 18 for it, somewhere around 1,000. Because it's in with, I don't know, the ballerina and whatever else is there they've got there. Oh.
Wow. So yeah, that's just that's one day in SAT these days, right?
The ballerina or the price?
I wouldn't know. I'm a lowly city worker now.
Yeah,
barely scraping by. Uh-huh. But yeah, no. Thanks a lot for coming on.
It was
a pleasure to have you. Get to learn more about the deep water diving monument that's going to be installed here in Santa Barbara. The importance of it. And yeah, it was great to hear about your guys' careers and your passions. Your passion for this, you know. Yeah.
Well, thank you for what you've done so far and for including us in your programs. It's any publicity we can get, it's for the benefit of the whole diving community. And we're grateful that you're doing what you're doing. Yeah. Maybe there'll be a reason to come back.
Nice.
I just think what you guys are doing is awesome. Podcast, you're promoting the industry, and kudos to both of you guys for taking the time. I know you have full-time jobs, and doing this on top of that is making the drive all the way up from Long Beach to do this. Much appreciated. So kudos to you guys. You're the future of this business, not guys like me and Leslie. You guys are the future, and you divers that are out there working right now, you are the future. So congratulations to all of you, and stay safe out there.
All right. Well, we'll see you on the next episode of The Bottom Dwellers Dive Shack.
I hope you've enjoyed listening to this episode of The Bottom Dwellers Dive Shack. Make sure you like and follow on our social media pages on Instagram and Facebook. Please share this podcast with your friends or anyone interested in commercial diving. The only way that we can make this successful is if we do get a lot of people that are listening. We get more listeners, we get more sponsors, and that means more free stuff for you guys. That's right. We are hooking up all of our diver brothers and sisters in the trade, and if you keep sharing and liking, we're able to do that a lot more. Our Instagram is at BottomDwellersDS. Our Facebook is BottomDwellersDiveShack. And you can always like and follow me at LB Diver on both. The Bottom Dwellers Dive Shack is available on all podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify, Anchor. We also have it streaming on our website at thebottomdwellers.com. So keep listening, keep it safe, keep it salty. This is LB Diver, out.